tattoo of a keyhole between her breasts. Ayers gets it. She's waiting for the person who holds the key to her heart. Cash must notice the tattoo at the same time. How could he not? It's nestled right there between her boobs, which are straining against the green cups of her bikini, because he says, "Cool tattoo." Maxwell glances down at her chest as if she has no idea what he's talking about. "Oh, thanks," she says. Over the bikini, she's wearing a sheer green paisley peasant blouse. She gives a tiny shrug, and the blouse slips down off her shoulder. This girl has all the moves, and she has her bright gaze trained on Cash. "I hope you don't mind my hanging around. It's just that I came on this trip by myself. I'm visiting a friend of mine from high school who lives here, but she said she has a lot of errands today because she works at night." Ayers can't help herself from jumping in. "Is your friend named Bridget by any chance?"
"No," Maxwell says.
"Long shot, I know," Ayers says. "You just remind me of someone."
"Anyway," Maxwell says, now showing Cash one creamy shoulder, "she encouraged me to come out on this tour. She said it's the best."
She beams at Cash, as though Treasure Island's sterling reputation is all Cash is doing.
"I think she was trying to get rid of me. I can be a lot."
"You?" Ayers says. The boat engine starts. Cash says, "I have to go tend to the ropes. Excuse me, Maxwell."
"Just call me Max," she says. "When you're finished, will you come back and make me a painkiller extra strong?"
"You got it," Cash says. He gives her a wink and shoots out a finger like Isaac, the bartender from The Love Boat, a cultural reference Ayers suspects is lost on Max. Ayers wrestles with her wandering mind. She told Cash she would keep an eye on the kids and let him handle the adults, but by now, all six of the boys might have drowned. Ayers puts on her headset.
"I'm about to give the safety talk," she says to Max. "You should listen."
The ride to Virgin Gorda is smooth. Ayers makes herself notice how glorious the water, the sky, and the emerald green islands are. She is so lucky to live here, to have this job and her job at Latapa, her friends, her community, Maya and Huck. Rosie is gone, but at least while Ayers is reading the journals, it feels like she has Rosie back. It feels like Rosie is, finally, telling her everything. But then she succumbs to the red, hot, itchy temptation of thinking about Mick and Bridget. Bridget! If Ayers had seen Mick with anyone else, Emily Ratajkowski, Scarlett Johansson with her tongue in Mick's ear, it wouldn't have sickened Ayers the way seeing him with Bridget has. Why did he even bother getting back together with her? Because she was hurting? Because he felt sorry for her? Because her apartment was far more homey and comfortable than the rat hole where he and Gordon lived? Is he using her? Preying on her pain and her wobbly judgment? She's actively mourning the loss of her best friend, and she has been trying to hold it together so she can be whole and strong for Maya. How dare Mick go behind her back again after all Ayers has just been through? That is what makes this unforgivable. She scans the boat, looking for anyone who seems to be suffering from seasickness. But the passengers look calm and happy, their faces turned toward the sun, hair blowing back in the breeze. The six boys are sitting on a bench between the statuesque bookends of their parents, and there isn't a single electronic device among them, which Ayers finds impressive. She leans toward the mother, Donna, and says, "Your boys are so well behaved." Donna wraps her arm around the youngest, Dougie, who is sitting next to her, and kisses the top of his head. "Believe me, this is a rare moment of peace. We told them if they behaved today, we'd rent a dinghy tomorrow and go to the pizza boat in Christmas Cove." "Good bribe," Ayers says. "I love pizza pie." Mick had said something the night before about borrowing his boss's boat so they could raft up in Christmas Cove on Monday. Eat pizza, listen to live music. Maybe now he'll take Bridget. "How do you manage six boys?" Ayers asks. Because she's an only child, she has always been fascinated by big families,
and she still harbors a fantasy of having a bunch of kids herself someday, which will probably never happen, seeing as how she can't even sustain a relationship. She has to lasso her psyche, stay in the moment. Isn't it a lot to keep track of their sports and activities and their dental appointments and haircuts and stuff? Just looking at the Dressler family brings up visions of reminders written on a chalkboard in the mudroom, a color-coded calendar, baskets labeled with each boy's name to hold hats and gloves and rain boots. "They're all swimmers," Donna says. "I just drop them off at the Y on Saturday morning and collect them at the end of the day. I go to some of the meets, though I've learned to pick and choose. I used to go to every single one and my hair turned green just from sitting in the pool balcony for so long," she laughs. "They aren't interested in impressing me anyway. They want to impress their coach, their teammates, and each other. They all swim freestyle and do the IM, so it's pretty intense competition." She looks down to the end of the bench and whispers, "DJ has just committed to swim at Stanford." "That's so cool," Ayers says. "Where are you guys from?" "Philadelphia," Donna says. "The main line." Sure, of course. Ayers might have predicted that. The Dresslers probably live in an old stone house that has a creek running behind it. The husband, Dave, probably takes the train downtown to work, and Donna probably makes enormous dinners, Taco Tuesdays, that the boys devour, exhausted from a day of school and swimming the 50 free in under a minute. Ayers feels herself falling in love with the Dressler family. "Adopt me, please," she thinks. But maybe there are secrets, like soft spots on a seemingly perfect apple. Maybe Donna is having an affair with the kid swim coach. Maybe Dave is a degenerate gambler who has lost the college savings. Maybe the oldest boy got his girlfriend pregnant, which he'll reveal the day they get home from this vacation, and suddenly Stanford will be called into question. Ayers shakes her head. What is wrong with her today? She suspects it's a combination of the diaries and seeing Mick and Bridget together. It feels like the whole world is hiding something. Ayers lifts her gaze from Donna to the cabin of the boat. The past 2 days, Cash has circulated around the boat and introduced himself to the guests, but there he is, behind the bar, making that chick Max another drink. In the 7 years that Ayers has been working on Treasure Island, she has seen a spectrum of eye-popping outfits, which she and Wade have put into three categories. Category one, the most popular, was the siren. This included teensy bikinis and wet t-shirts. Category two was the Riviera Gigolo, a gentle way of describing men who wore, instead of trunks, European-cut briefs, nut-huggers, grape smugglers, banana hammocks. Category three was the vampire. These folks showed up in head-to-toe lycra, usually black for some reason, because they couldn't risk exposure to the sun. The lycra suits were always accompanied by wide-brimmed floppy hats. Ayers was all about SPF, but in her opinion, if exposure to sunlight was that verboten, then a day trip on Treasure Island, hell, a vacation on a Caribbean island in general, probably wasn't for you. Once Max takes the paisley peasant blouse off and slides out of her jean shorts, Ayers sees that the green bikini consists of only three tiny triangles of iridescent material, probably meant to reference fish scales, and some string. It's a dental floss thong, leaving the pale orbs of Max's buttocks exposed. Ayers notices a tattoo on the right cheek, a pair of lips. "Kiss my ass," Ayers thinks. "Got it." Max's body is a living rebus. Ayers is dismayed that Max chose to wear such a revealing suit on a family-oriented boat trip. What must the six boys think? At least half of them will be ogling her all day. It's impossible not to ogle her. Donna gives Ayers a sympathetic smile. "If you've got it, flaunt it." That's a generous perspective, Ayers thinks. She will bet anyone the keys to her truck that Max is going to lose her bikini when she jumps off the boat to swim into the baths. Ayers puts on her headset and runs through the drill. Jump in, swim to shore, here are the life vests, and does anyone need a noodle? Everyone does just fine, including 6-year-old Dougie, and then Max climbs up to the edge of the bow and turns around in a panic. Where's Cash? She says. I want Cash to go with me. He's on shore already, Max, Ayers says. See him there? Cash is standing on the small golden beach herding everyone toward the entrance of the baths. He's going to lead the tour today, and Ayers is bringing up the rear. Just jump in and swim right for him, okay? Oh, okay, Max says. She waves both arms overhead. Cash! Cash! She loses her footing and falls in. Ayers peers over the edge, checking to see whether Max can swim or if Ayers will have to save her. To be safe, Ayers jumps in a few feet away. You okay? Max is busy doing the doggy paddle, eyes squeezed shut. And because she is actually making forward progress, Ayers lets her be, swimming behind her just in case. She can't believe this chick isn't a friend of Bridget. Looks like you have a barnacle on your boat, Ayers says to Cash once they're all back aboard Treasure Island. Max had trailed Cash through the bath so closely that whenever he stopped, she bumped into him. At Cathedral, she jumped off the ledge into his arms and clung to him far longer than was necessary. Huh? Cash says. Oh, yeah. She's harmless. They both turn to see Max standing at the bar, waiting for Cash so he can make her another drink and she can show him her chest. James anchors off the coast of Norman Island for snorkeling because there are already 3 boats parked over at the Indians. Cash helps everyone with equipment, and Ayers goes to see how the Dressler boys are faring. They're all set, Donna says, but thank you. Ayers finds herself with a free minute, and she's in a spot that has reliable cell service. Should she check her phone? See if Mick responded? No, she decides. If he knows what's good for him, he'll ditch Bridget and be waiting at the dock for Ayers, smoothie in hand. Is that what she wants? She checks her phone despite herself. There are 2 texts from Mick, but Cash has started sending people into the water. She has to go. Ayers snorkels with the Dressler boys and encourages 2 of the middle ones to follow her over to a rocky outcrop of Norman where the spotted eagle rays like to hang out. She can hear the boys oohing and aahing through their snorkels, and as always, this makes her happy. Some things are more important than her romantic trials and tribulations. Things like wonder. Ayers raises her head and sees everyone heading back to the boat. She lets the boys swim ahead and she brings up the rear, scanning the water for the fluorescent orange tape on the tips of snorkels. When she climbs up to the deck, she says, "Everyone accounted for?" "Yes," Cash says. Ayers signals James, who starts the engine, and Cash goes to pull the anchor, which makes his muscles pop in a way that is undeniably attractive. Ayers can't believe Max isn't right beside him, taking pictures for her Instagram account, #coldheartcash. When the anchor is up and they're moving, Ayers says, "Where's the barnacle?" "Wait," Cash says, "what?" Panic in the form of absolute stillness seizes Ayers. "Stop the boat!" she yells. Max is not dead, and Max is not lost. Ayers repeats this like a mantra, though for the first 30 seconds after Ayers realizes Max isn't on the boat, how can she not be on the boat? And why did Cash say everyone was present? Did he not do a head count? These are Ayers' prevailing thoughts, that Max is dead or Max is missing and will turn up dead. James cuts the engines, and Ayers races up to the top deck with the binoculars, trying not to exude any sign of the sheer terror she is feeling. But the rest of the guests realize something is wrong. Ayers overhears Cash say, "We're missing someone, the woman in the green bikini." Then everyone starts looking. They spread out around the port side and starboard side and the bow. Ayers' main concern is that Max is under the boat, that they unwittingly ran over her when they lifted anchor and started toward Joost van Dyke. Max is not dead, and Max is not lost, Ayers tells herself. Cash appears next to her. "I'm so sorry," I thought. "There's no time for sorry," Ayers says. She mentally breaks the water into a grid and starts scanning it square foot by square foot. In 7 years, she has never lost a swimmer. She has had to do only 5 rescues, 5 in 7 years. Today will be her 6th rescue, she tells herself. Today, she will rescue Max. Someone calls out, "Over there!" Ayers follows the pointing arm of Mr. Dressler. Yes, she sees a piece of fluorescent tape about 200 yards away. Before Ayers knows what's happening, someone dives off the lower deck of the boat and starts swimming toward the snorkeler. It's the oldest Dressler kid, DJ, Ayers realizes. She strips off her shorts and, although it's forbidden, she dives off the top deck, hits the water with so much force that her nose and ears flood with water, and swims after him. A second later, she feels the concussion of someone else plunging in nearby, and she envisions everyone on the boat trying to be a hero. She raises her head in order to get her bearings. Cash goes thrashing past her. He's moving so fast he nearly catches DJ. Ayers sees DJ and then Cash reach the snorkeler, and Ayers hears shouts. She swims closer, and only then does she realize that the snorkeler isn't a she. The snorkeler isn't Max. It's some guy from another boat who has also gone rogue. "Go back to your boat!" Ayers yells to the other snorkeler. She casts about helplessly. Where is Max? She hears the air horn and swivels her head to see Captain James on the top deck windmilling his arm to beckon her back. "What?" Ayers thinks. "We can't just leave her here, or..." Has Max turned up? DJ and Cash are already swimming back to the boat, and Ayers puts her head down and powers forward with everything she's got left, thinking, "Please let her be okay. Please let her be alive." If she's injured, they can get her to Schneider Hospital on St. Thomas in 30 minutes. When Ayers is only a few yards from the boat, James calls out, "She's aboard."
"She is?"
"She was in the head," James says. "Why didn't you guys check?" "In the head. Max was using the bathroom."
"Why didn't Ayers check?"
Sure enough, Max is sitting on the stairs to the upper deck, which isn't allowed, drinking what's left of a painkiller when Ayers hauls herself up the ladder. Ayers can't bring herself to say anything to the girl. What would she say?
"We thought we'd lost you. We thought you drowned."
At which point, Max would say, "I went to the bathroom. Sorry, I didn't know I needed to report in. I wanted to change my swimsuit." Because, yep, Max is wearing a new bikini, white, which Ayers will, again, bet the key to her truck becomes completely see-through when wet. Ayers climbs past Max without a word and goes into the wheelhouse to apologize to James.
"I'm sorry," she says. "I should have checked the head. I..."
Ayers tries to explain what made her jump to the conclusion that Max was still in the water. All Cash had said was, "Wait, what?" Ayers was the one who had panicked.
"She'd been drinking, more than everyone else combined. I guess my mind supplied the worst-case scenario, that she went out snorkeling while drunk and she drowned."
James gives her the eyebrows. He's a man of few words, though he's been blessed with wisdom beyond his years. He's 35. He went to high school with Rosie, and a dry sense of humor. "If I didn't know you better, I'd say you were jealous."
"Jealous of Max?" Ayers says. "Please give me some credit."
"She's been hanging on your boy," James says, "and we both know it's not like you to fly off like that."
"First of all, he's not my boy," Ayers says. "Is that what you think?"
James starts the engine.
"I'd like permission to cut her off," Ayers says. "She's had enough to drink."
"She didn't do anything wrong," James says. He leaves it unspoken that this whole event was Ayers' fault. Ayers can only imagine what kind of dramatic retelling the 14 adults will provide on TripAdvisor.
"I'm sorry," Ayers says again. "I'm having a bad day."
James nods. "You're allowed," he says. He laughs.
Tell you what, though, your boy sure can swim.
Ayers puts on the headset. Sorry about that, folks, she says. She notices that the Dressler kids are all lined up at the railing, seeing who can spit the farthest, and there's now a queue at the bar 3 deep. Right, she thinks. Crisis averted, people are getting bored, time to drink. We're on our way over to Joost van Dyck, named for the man who discovered it in the early 17th century. It became a center of custom shipbuilding, but now, however, Joost is most famous for its world-class beach bars, including Foxy's, One Love, and the Soggy Dollar. Everyone claps. She's forgiven. There's no happier place on Earth than White Bay on a sunny day. The stunning crescent of powder-fine sand is lined with palm trees and funky, bare-bones beach bars. Treasure Island slips in among a flotilla of boats. There are people splashing in the shallows, tossing a football. There's reggae music and the smell of jerk chicken and the low buzz of blenders making bushwhackers and piña coladas. Please get yourself some lunch, Ayers says, and try not to wander off. We'd like you back on the boat at 2:30 sharp. Ayers counts the Dressler kids as they jump off the boat in succession. There's a bit of a wade required, which the boys don't seem to mind. To DJ, Ayers says, thank you for your help. You're a fast swimmer. DJ shrugs, and Donna Dressler puts a hand on Ayers' shoulder and says, that was some unexpected drama, huh? Ayers spies Max walking down the beach, with Cash, of course, toward the Soggy Dollar. I don't know if I should feel angry or relieved. Sounds like being a parent, Donna says. You're not sure whether to ground them or hug them. Grounding sounds good, Ayers thinks. Lunch isn't a bad idea, and Ayers is a big fan of the Soggy Dollar lobster roll, so she walks down the beach and into the bar. Her favorite bartender, Leon, is pouring something pink and fruity out of the blender and into 2 cups, which he delivers to Max and Cash, who are sitting together at the end of the bar. Cash says, I'm on the clock, and passes his drink to Max. Aw, she says, thanks. She leans her head on Cash's shoulder and closes her eyes. Did Ayers give Cash the talk about not fraternizing with the guests? She knows she didn't. It never occurred to her that it would be a problem. Cash had been so earnest, so eager to please her, Ayers, that she hadn't realized that many, if not all the available women, and maybe even those who weren't necessarily available, would find Cash sexy and attractive and throw themselves at him as inelegantly as moths beating themselves against a screen. Cash nudges Max's head off his shoulder and orders a Coke and a blackened mahi sandwich with coleslaw. He says, so what do you do for work? I sell drugs, Max says. She waits a beat, then honks out a laugh. Not what you're thinking. I'm a pharmaceutical rep.
Did you grow up in the Midwest? Cash asks.
Peoria, she says,
diving nose first into her pink drink.
I'm from Iowa City, Cash says.
Ayers isn't eavesdropping. She's just waiting to get Leon's attention. It's like she's invisible today. She debates interrupting the happy couple to remind Max to eat something, but she's not the girl's mother, and she's afraid of sounding like a schoolmarm or a scold. Max says something under her breath, and Cash laughs. Is Ayers jealous? Maybe she is. She had thought Cash was in love with her. She thought Cash had taken the job on Treasure Island because he wanted to work with her. And yet he hasn't looked over at her even once. He's completely entranced with Max. Ayers can't believe she's having these thoughts. She doesn't like Cash in that way, does she? She doesn't think so, but right now, there's no denying she's jealous. No, Ayers thinks. She enjoys being the object of Cash's affection. It's flattering, a boost to her ego. What's really going on is that she's upset about Mick and Bridget and confused about her feelings for Baker. Baker, who is maybe staying on St. John, but also maybe not staying. Ayers would bet the keys to her truck and her apartment that Baker will go back to Houston for the school fundraiser and never return. He'll find relocating too complicated. He'll spend 2 weeks on St. John and become bored. Without a job to do, it's just sun, sand, and water. There are no museums or movie theaters. There are no professional sports teams or shopping malls. There isn't even any golf. He won't stay. The schools won't be good enough for Floyd. Baker won't be able to find a fulfilling job. St. John isn't Wall Street. There will be some solid reason why he has to go back to the States. St. John is paradise when you visit, but when you live here, it becomes very real very quickly. Ayers can't risk getting involved with Baker.
Ayers, Cash says suddenly, yanking her out of her mental quicksand, would you like to join us?
Ayers assesses her options. Cash's sandwich has now arrived, and he offers some to Max, who slowly, slowly shakes her head. She's slipping down her stool, melting like a candle.
Leon finally gives Ayers a wave. I see you, darling. Just gonna be a minute.
That's okay, Leon, Ayers says. I'm not staying.
She steps back out onto the sand. She'll head down to One Love, she decides, and get some jerk pork. At 2:15, Ayers is feeling a little better. She has eaten and taken a 10-minute chair nap, and now she combs the beach for her guests, urging everyone to head back to the boat. If they get out of here at 2:30, there will be less of a line at customs. Ayers has never wanted a charter to end so badly. Coming toward her down the beach are Cash and Max. Max is stumbling and bent over. She's so drunk she can barely walk. Cash has to take her by the hand once they're wading back to the boat. If she fell over, she would drown in only 2 feet of water. Ayers wants to say something to Cash, something like, why did you let her get so drunk? She wants to point to Max and say to James, we should have cut her off after snorkeling. But instead, Ayers helps Cash get Max up the 3-step ladder and onto the boat. Max heads toward starboard, and Ayers thinks maybe she's going to the bar for another drink, but she bypasses the cabin, pushes little Dougie Dressler out of the way, and starts puking over the side of the boat. Ayers bows her head. It would be very unprofessional to let the others see her smirking.
Cash.
He's not sure how he got saddled with the drunk and now crying young woman named Maxwell. Well, yes, he does know. He enabled her drinking and indulged her little crush on him because she's attractive and flirtatious, and both of these things seemed to bother Ayers, which was, he thought, a very good sign, but now he's responsible for making sure she gets home safely. Find her friend, her people, whoever, Ayers says. I'll clean the boat by myself. And please, Cash, don't let this happen again. These are our guests, not our friends.
You're right, he says. It won't happen again.
He half leads, half carries Max off the dock and into the streets of St. John. As they pulled into port, he'd asked Max the name of her friend from high school, but all she'd said was, I dunno, and then she groaned and started vomiting again. It hadn't been a good look for her, for him, or for Treasure Island, though everyone else on the boat seemed to take it in stride. The parents of the 6 boys used it as a cautionary tale. That, Cash overheard the father whisper to the Stanford-bound DJ, is what happens when you decide 3 shots of tequila sound good after midnight. There was a couple on the boat, keen snorkelers who'd brought a checklist of fish they were hoping to see, and the man said, I could have told you how this was going to end up, but she was having so much fun, I hated to put a damper on it. We've all been there, his wife said. For me, it was the Sig Epp house at West Virginia University in 1996. Cash tended to agree. Many people at some point in their lives had overdone it like Max. Cash had sampled his father's scotch and smoked one of his cigars when he was a week away from graduating high school, and that had ended badly. And he had taken care of Claire Bellows after she drank Jägermeister from a flask in the bathroom during their junior prom.
The town is teeming with people. All of the tour boats have just disgorged their passengers, and it's happy hour at nearly every bar in Cruz Bay. Cash has no leads on who he should hand this chick off to. No one seems to be waiting for her. Cash then tries to imagine bringing Max home to the villa where Baker, Floyd, and his mother will all be waiting. Nope, no chance.
Cash!
Cash cranes his neck, trying to figure out who's calling his name. Then someone appears under his nose. It's Maya, with a boy in tow, a handsome young man with dark hair that has been highlighted in the front. He's a couple inches taller than Maya. Hey, Cash says. He's more than a little uncomfortable bumping into, well, his little sister, with Max draped over him like a fur coat. What are you doing? Maya shrugs.
Hanging out?
She nods at the boy next to her.
This is my friend Shane. He goes to Antilles.
Hey, Shane, Cash says.
Shane is the kid that Maya has a crush on. Cash remembers this much. It's nice that they're hanging out together. Alone, from the looks of it. Is that okay? And Cash feels honored to be introduced, but he really wishes it wasn't under these circumstances. Any minute, Max might projectile vomit onto Shane's shoes.
What are you doing?
Maya asks, taking an appraising look at Max.
Well, this woman was a guest on the boat, and I'm trying to find her friend. She has a friend who lives here, she said, but I have no idea who it is or what to do.
Is it Tilda?
Maya asks.
She was just here looking for her friend who was visiting from Chicago.
Maya turns to Shane. Did she say Chicago? Shane nods.
Definitely Chicago, he says. But I thought her friend was a boy.
Was she looking for a Max?
Cash asks.
Maxwell?
Yes,
Maya says.
Tilda is her friend?
Cash says.
Really? The Tilda that I know? Tilda from La Tapa?
Yeah, Maya says. She worked with my mom.
Right. Yes, yes,
Cash says. He's forgotten that everyone on this island is connected.
I'm going to sit with Max on this bench. Can you guys go find Tilda and tell her where we are?
Come on,
Shane says, clearly energized by this mission. He takes Maya's hand and leads her across the street toward the docks. Is it okay that they're holding hands? Cash wonders. They look pretty darn cute.
This way, Max. Easy does it. Here we go,
Cash says. He sighs. He would give anything to be 12 again.
I am so sorry about this, Tilda says. I'm mortified. I told her to behave herself. I told her I worked with Ayers, and I'd forgotten that you were working on the boat now, too. That makes it so much worse.
You don't have to apologize, Cash says. It's not your fault.
Cash offered to help Tilda get Max settled at home, and now he leans back into the soft leather seat of Tilda's Range Rover and enjoys the air conditioning blowing full blast. Max is lying across the back seat, moaning. Tilda laid a beach towel across the floor of the car in case Max throws up again, although she's been at it for so long that Cash doesn't see how there could be anything left in her stomach.
I think maybe she was just nervous about going on the trip by herself.
She should have made some friends, Tilda says.
She sort of attached herself to me, Cash says.
Of course she did, Tilda says. You're super hot and you're her type. You look exactly like her boyfriend in high school, Freddie Jarvis.
Cash isn't sure how he feels about being the reincarnation of high school boyfriend Freddie Jarvis. If he'd seen a woman who looked like Claire Bellows, he would have steered clear.
I don't think Ayers was too happy about it.
Oh, please, Tilda says, as if Ayers isn't hit on herself every single charter.
Is she? Cash says. She wasn't today.
That's rare, Tilda says, but Ayers is used to it. She never succumbs to temptation because she loves Mick.
Tilda pauses.
Did you hear me, Cash? She loves Mick.
I heard you, Cash says.
Tilda pulls up a steep incline called Upper Peter Bay, and they go up, up, up until they can't go any farther. There's a gate.
Tilda punches in the code, and then they shoot down a driveway that's so steep, Cash feels like he's on a luge or a log flume in the amusement park. They arrive, finally, at the villa, which is absolutely stunning. It's three separate buildings in the Spanish mission style, attached by arched columned walkways.
Okay,
Cash says. It's my parents, Tilda says, as is this rover. They only come three times a year, and I have the West Wing to myself. She parks the car. Max is staying in the guest wing.
Cash follows Tilda through the main entrance into a foyer that's two stories high. Everything is white, with accents of palm green and the palest blue. To the right is a sweeping curved staircase. Above it hangs a long, dripping chandelier that looks like crystal rain. In front of them is a white and pale blue living room and a white kitchen with a very cool curved bar around which are pale blue suede stools. Beyond the kitchen are floor-to-ceiling sliding doors that open out onto a patio and a T-shaped pool.
That pool, Cash whispers.
He's carrying Max like a bride over the threshold. She's snoring.
The pool is for Granger, my dad, Tilda says. He's very intense about his swimming. About everything, actually.
Tilda sighs.
The only person who makes him seem relaxed is my mom. Now she's a maniac.
Cash wants to hear more, but Max is getting heavy. Which way? They head out a side door and down one of the covered walkways into the guest wing. It's two stories, complete with its own garden and plunge pool. They are so high up that Cash can see all of Yost Van Dyke and Tortola. The bedroom is on the first floor. Tilda throws Max's bag down and hurries to sweep back the white sheets from the side of the mahogany four-poster bed so Cash can set Max on it. It's like they're in some kind of weird fairy tale. Max rolls onto her side and continues to snore.
She needs to sleep it off, Tilda says. Wanna go get a drink?
Yes, Cash says. As a matter of fact, I do.
They go back to town, and Tilda picks a place called the Lime Inn, where they sit at the open-air horseshoe-shaped bar. Tilda orders them each a cocktail called the Danger, which is probably the exact opposite of what Cash needs right now, but he rolls with it.
So your parents
run an international headhunting firm, Tilda says, specializing in IT. My mother is the owner and CEO, and my father is the CFO. I'm proud of them. When I was young, my mother worked in HR at a software company in Peoria, and my father was a financial advisor for a lot of the top execs at Caterpillar. Then, when I was 8, my mother had an idea for this business. We moved to Chicago right before I started high school, and by the time I was a freshman at Lake Forest, their company was everywhere. India, Australia, Eastern Europe, South Africa.
It's not so different from Cash's own story. Russ took the job with Ascension when Cash was 16, and life changed. For the better, he'd thought at the time.
My parents want to invest in a business for me, Tilda says, but I'm not sure what I want to do yet. So I'm living down here, waiting tables at La Tapa, and I volunteer at the animal shelter.
You do? Cash says.
I love dogs, Tilda says, but I can't have one because a White House.
I have a golden retriever named Winnie, Cash says. She's my world.
I'd love to meet your world sometime, Tilda says. Should we have one more danger, or do you have to go?
Cash thinks about it for a second. Let's have one more, he says. Tilda is cool, and she's really smart. She has a degree in economics from Lake Forest. She gave business school some thought, but she's grown attached to St. John.
I'm thinking about starting an eco-tour company here, she says. Hiking, kayaking, snorkeling. But I'd want to provide lodging, too, I think, so I've been checking out real estate. I'm not going to jump into anything.
I wish I'd been as savvy as you, Cash says.
He taps his fingers alongside his glass, wondering how in-depth he wants to get with Tilda. You know that my father was killed in the helicopter crash with Rosie?
You told me, Tilda says. A few weeks ago, when you were hitchhiking and I picked you up? You remember that night, right?
Kind of, he says.
He remembers Tilda picking him up. He hadn't recognized her as working at La Tapa until she reminded him. That was the night he'd gotten drunk at high tide after his fight with Baker. He can't recall a thing that he and Tilda talked about. At that point, Tilda had been a minor character, someone in the background. But now that Cash is getting to know her, he's intrigued. It's enough of a plot twist that she's a child of enormous wealth, but it's an even greater twist that, despite this, she works her ass off and volunteers and is researching business ventures. So what did I tell you about my dad? That he had been killed in the copter crash, that he was Rosie's lover, and that he'd bought you 2 outdoor supply stores in Denver that went under.
I told you that? Ouch. I can't believe you're still sitting here with me.
You invited me to Breckenridge to ski, Tilda says. You made me promise I would come.
Cash laughs. Did I?
And Tilda fiddles with the straw in her drink. You told me that both you and your brother were in love with Ayers.
Cash drops his head into his hands. Idiot, he says. I'm an idiot.
They decide to stay at the Lime Inn for dinner. Tilda gets the grilled lobster, which she says is the best on the island, and Cash gets the guava pork ribs, and when their food comes, they push their plates together and share.
Eco-tourism, huh? Cash says. Do you like to hike?
Obsessed, Tilda says. I'm trying to do every hike on the island this year.
I told Maya I'd do the Esperance Trail with her, Cash says.
To see the baobab tree? Tilda says, I haven't done that one yet.
Well, let's plan a time and you can come with us, Cash says.
Are you asking me on a date? Tilda says. She leans into him, much like Max did at lunch. But instead of being irritating, it feels nice. Tilda smells good. She's tomboyish, which he finds sexy. Her short hair draws attention to her light brown eyes.
A date? Cash says. Aren't we on a date now?
Are we?
Tilda says. I don't know. Aren't we?
Maybe we shouldn't examine it too closely, Tilda says.
Maybe you're right, Cash says. The hike would be with Maya, so I don't know how romantic it would be.
No kissing under the baobab tree? Tilda says.
Cash puts his hand over Tilda's. I wouldn't rule it out.
Tilda turns her hand so that it's clasping his. Cash feels a rush. Does he like Tilda? Just do me one favor, Tilda says.
Okay, Cash says.
Don't use me as a substitute for Ayers.
What?
Cash says.
I know what I supposedly told you in the car, but I was very drunk. Ayers and I are just friends.
I'm not stupid, Cash. Tilda says, and I don't blame you. I get it. Ayers is a queen. She's the complete package. I know you and your brother both have a thing for her.
Baker might, Cash says, but I...
You do too, Tilda says. Trust me, I get it. If I were still in my lesbian phase, I'd go after Ayers. Cash takes a deep breath. This has been a very long, very strange day.
Lesbian phase?
High school, Tilda says.
Max? Cash asks.
Tilda swats him. Come on, let's get a nightcap. They walk hand in hand over to La Tapa. It's kind of a thing we do, Tilda says. Whenever we're out on our nights off, we stop in for a drink.
I would think it'd be the last place you'd want to go, Cash says.
Except we all love it, Tilda says. It's so gratifying to watch everyone else work.
Okay, Cash says.
He wonders if Ayers will be there and, if she is, what she'll think when she sees him with Tilda. Will she be jealous?
She had been jealous of Cash's attention to Max, that's for damn sure.
Cash worries that he is using Tilda, but he likes Tilda, and he doesn't want to stop holding her hand. Maybe he shouldn't examine it too closely. By the time they reach La Tapa, service has ended. Ayers is nowhere to be seen, though there are still a few people sitting at the bar.
Cash and Tilda take seats on the corner, and Skip, the bartender, looks between the two of them and glowers.
"Hey, Skip," Cash says.
"So what, are you two together now?" he asks. He glares at Tilda.
"I'll have a glass of the Schramsberg, please," Tilda says.
"Beer for me," Cash says. "Island hoppin', please."
"I'm helping these people right now," Skip says. He holds up a bottle of wine for the couple sitting next to Cash to inspect. "This is the Penfolds Bin 8 cab. It has notes of imitation crab meat, hot asphalt, and a one-night stand."
Nervously, the couple laughs. Tilda says, "Don't do this, Skip."
Skip opens the bottle with a flourish and pours some in the woman's glass. She brings it to her lips.
"I can definitely taste the one-night stand," she says. "The asphalt is harder to detect."
"He's a maniac," Tilda whispers.
"What's going on with you two?" Cash asks.
"Nothing," Tilda says, and I do mean nothing.
"But something did happen, right?" Cash says. "Let me guess. You had a thing, then you broke it off, and he's pissed. That's the vibe I'm getting."
"A very short thing," Tilda says, "a very insignificant thing."
Cash puts his hand on the slender stalk of Tilda's neck and pulls her in close.
"Tell you what," he says, "I promise not to use you as a substitute for Ayers, if you promise not to use me as revenge for old Skippy here. Deal?"
Tilda pantomimes picking up a glass. Her champagne has not yet and may never arrive, and raises it to Cash.
"Deal," she says.
Hawk. At the end of his first week of fishing with Irene, he writes down the following in his ledger. Monday, 3 adults, 1 child, last name Ford, Calabasas, California. 2 hardnose, 1 blue runner, 2 blackfin, 1 keeper. Tuesday, 2 adults, last name Pullman, Winchester, Massachusetts, 2 mahi, 2 keepers. Wednesday, 2 adults, 3 children, last name Tony, Excelsior, Minnesota, 2 barracuda, 3 wahoo, 3 keepers. Thursday, 2 adults, 4 children, last name Petrushki, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, 6 wahoo, 6 keepers, 2 mahi, 2 keepers. Friday, 4 adults, last name Chang, Whitefish Bay, Wisconsin, 3 barracuda, 3 mahi, 3 keepers, 1 wahoo, keeper. These are the usual details that Huck records, along with the credit card numbers or a notation that the client paid with cash. He used to include where the clients were staying on the island and how they'd heard about his charter, but then he decided it didn't make any difference. Nearly everyone finds him one of two ways, word of mouth or the GD internet. Huck pays a computer whiz named Destiny over in St. Thomas to make sure that when someone types in deep sea fishing and St. John USVI, the Mississippi is the first link to pop up. Destiny also runs the cards and sends Huck a brief text the night before a charter so he knows what he'll be dealing with the following day. What Huck doesn't write down is the way that having Irene on the boat has changed the experience of going to work. Adam was good. Adam was great. He was technically sound with the rods and the gaff. He was excellent when driving the boat. And he was usually pretty friendly with the clients. Some more than others, of course. But that's true of Huck as well. Huck doesn't need to be friendly. He's the captain. His only responsibilities are keeping everyone safe and putting people on fish. If Huck had any reservations about hiring Irene, and yeah, there had been a couple moments when he'd wondered if he was making a giant mistake, they were erased on the very first day. Irene showed up at the boat even before he did, bringing 2 cups of good, strong black coffee and 2 sausage biscuits from provisions. She was wearing shorts with pockets and a long-sleeved fishing shirt and a visor and sunglasses. Her hair was in that fat braid of hers, and she looked every inch like the fisherwoman of Huck's dreams. He had forwarded Destiny's text to Irene, so she knew they were expecting three adults and one child from Calabasas, wherever that was, someplace in California.
Los Angeles suburb, Irene said. The Kardashians live there.
I don't know who that is,
Huck said gruffly, though he did, sort of, because he lived with a 12-year-old girl. The three adults turned out to be a gay couple, Brian and Raphael, and a drop-dead gorgeous Swedish au pair who wore only a bikini and a sarong. They wandered down the dock with an 8-year-old boy who was crying. Irene looked at Huck and said, "We'll stay inshore?"
I love you, Huck thought.
You bet,
he said. The charter, one Huck and Adam might have written off as a bad blind date due to the crying child and uninterested nanny, had been a big success. Brian was an interior designer to the stars who had zero interest in fishing. Raphael was Brazilian and had grown up fishing in Recife, so he was enthusiastic. The au pair lay across the bench seating in the sun, and Irene, somehow, worked magic with the kid, whose name was Benny. She not only got him casting, but helped him when he got a bite. Together, Irene and Benny reeled in a blue runner. It wasn't a keeper, but it was a good-looking fish in pictures. Raphael caught two hard noses and a blackfin that was too small to keep, but all that action made him happy. While checking everyone's lines, Irene chatted with Brian about restoration glass, whatever that was, and epoxy floors, whatever those were. The coup de grace, however, came near the end of the trip when Irene encouraged the au pair, Mathilde, to cast a line, and she caught a nice-sized blackfin that they could take home. It was big enough for a sushi appetizer.
That's the first useful thing she's done all week, Brian whispered.
Huck watched him slip Irene a $100 bill. Huck figured that was beginner's luck. However, the entire week had gone smoothly. No matter who walked down the dock, Irene was ready. Friendly, but not too familiar. Adam would have fallen all over himself with the Swedish au pair. After the first day with Benny, Irene made a habit of bringing snacks, boxes of cheese crackers, bags of hard pretzels. On Friday, Irene showed up with 2 dozen lemongrass sugar cookies, and after Huck tasted one, he took the whole bag from her and said, "These are too good to share." Irene laughed and tried to take the bag back, and soon they were in a tug-of-war, and Irene shrieked, "Huck, you're going to turn them to crumbs!" Her tone was playful, and the delight on her face made her look even younger and more beautiful than the Swedish au pair. And Huck had relented because at that moment, all he wanted to do was kiss her. He didn't, of course. He couldn't. Not on the boat, not while she was working for him. That wasn't the first time he realized he might be falling in love with Irene. The first time it hit him was Thursday, when they had the family from Chapel Hill on board. The Petrushkis were a mixed-race couple, husband a big white dude, wife a dark-skinned lady, and they had 4 children, twin 14-year-old girls, Emma and Jane, a 10-year-old son, Woody, and a 4-year-old son named Elton. Huck had no opinion, really, when it came to children. All he wanted to know was whether they were interested in fishing and, if not, whether they were able to sit on a boat for 6 or 8 hours without causing trouble. If a child was cute or not didn't enter his brain. All children were cute, except for Maya, who was exquisite. But even Huck would have had a hard time saying that Elton Petrushki wasn't the cutest child he'd ever seen. He had cafe au lait skin like Maya, big brown eyes and chubby cheeks, and as soon as he climbed aboard the boat, he attached himself to Irene and started asking,
"We gone fish? We gone fish?"
Irene said, "Yes, yes, Elton, we gone fish."
"We gone fish,"
Elton announced to Huck. Elton sat with his mother for the trip offshore. Huck was always worried about taking children offshore, but Mr. Petrushki assured him that the kids had grown up on the water. The Petrushkis owned a vacation home on Wrightsville Beach on the North Carolina coast, and they boated around Cape Fear. When they slowed down to troll out at Tambo, the fertile spot where Huck and Irene had had such phenomenal luck just after the new year, Huck ran through the drill with Mr. Petrushki and the older kids. He was extra kind and solicitous. Maybe he was trying to show off for Irene, while she dealt with little Elton, who was dead set on catching a fish of his own.
"He gets a fish on, you hold his rod," Huck said. "Wahoo gets a hold of that line, kid's going in, shark bait."
"Understood, Captain," Irene said. "Nothing is going to happen to this child in my care." The Petrushki family had, in fact, enjoyed a banner day. Mr. Petrushki got a fish on first. Huck was secretly relieved because plenty of time he had seen grown men bitter about being shown up by their own children. Then Huck tossed Chum into the water and they got more hits. Mister brought in a wahoo, then one of the twins brought in a smaller wahoo. Then a few minutes later, the other twin brought in a wahoo exactly the same size. It was almost eerie. With the appearance of each fish, Elton Petrushki would jump up and down and yell, "Got fish! Got fish!" He stood over the hold, staring down with wide eyes as Huck tossed the fish in. There was a little bit of a lull at one point, but Huck saw birds diving and directed the boat over. Sure enough, the 10-year-old Woody caught a barracuda, and then Mr. Petrushki caught a barracuda. Mrs. Petrushki was reading a book bigger than the Bible, The Collected Works of Jane Austen. "I love Jane Austen," Irene said. "So do I," Mrs. Petrushki said. "I'm a professor at UNC. I teach the Austen Survey course." "Oh, I get it now," Irene said. "The children's names, Emma, Jane, Wood for Woodhouse, and Elton." "Yes, I did my thesis on Emma," Mrs. Petrushki said. "I'm a bit obsessed, as my girls like to say." Huck was in awe at the same time that he felt like an illiterate dummy. Mrs. Petrushki closed her book and beamed. "Looks like wahoo for dinner." Elton gazed up at Irene. "We goin' fish?" "We goin' fish," Irene said. She got a determined set to her mouth. "Elton is taking the next fish." A few minutes later, they had a bite. Irene steered Elton to the port rod. "We have a bite, Elton," she said. "We are going to reel in your fish, but you have to do exactly what I say." "Listen to Miss Irene," Mrs. Petrushki said. Irene showed Elton how to spin the reel. Meanwhile, she had her hand firmly on the rod. Huck could see the tight clench of her fingers, and he was glad. The rod bowed dramatically. This was a big fish. "Irene," Huck said. "We've got it, Captain," she said. "This is Elton's fish." The fish put up a terrific fight, Huck thought, and by terrific, he meant terrible. Irene could maybe have brought the fish up alone, but she had Elton squeezed between her legs and her hand over his hand on the reel. Huck was about ready to suggest she pass the kid off to his mother when he saw the flash of green gold under the surface. He grabbed the gaff and brought up a gorgeous bull mahi that was nearly as big as the one Irene had brought up their first time out. The other kids were impressed, and Elton was beside himself. "My fish! My fish!" As soon as Huck yanked the gaff out and extracted the hook, they all watched the fish flop on the deck while Elton danced alongside it, yelling his head off with joy. Elton decided he wanted to sit next to Irene going home, and it was then, as Huck caught a glimpse of the two of them, Irene with her face raised to the mellow late afternoon sun, Elton Petrushki tucked under one arm, that he realized he was in serious danger of falling in love with the woman. When Huck looked at Irene, he could see the future. That could be her, 15 years from now, with Maya's child. After their charter on Friday with the Changs, who had wanted to stay inshore and fly fish, Huck and Irene cleaned the boat. The boat was never this spick and span when Adam did the cleaning. And then Huck hands Irene her first paycheck, which he wrote out that morning at home and says,
"Good job this week, Angler Cupcake."
She looks at the check, raises one eyebrow and says, "I had so much fun. I feel bad taking your money."
"You earned it," Huck says.
He wants to tell her how different work was this week compared to every other week of the past 6 years since Leanne died, but he finds a lump in his throat.
I couldn't ask for a better mate.
Really? She says. Huck fears if he gives her any specific compliments, all of his feelings will come tumbling out and he'll embarrass them both.
Next week we have driving lessons.
I signed up for the online marine safety class, she says.
Good girl, Huck says.
He unties his neckerchief and wipes off his forehead. The sun is starting its descent, and Huck can already hear the hooting, hollering, and steel drum music that characterize Cruise Bay on a Friday night.
So, do you have big plans for the weekend?
I'm going to sleep in, she says, go for a swim or two, read, spend time with the boys, and check in with my attorney at home.
You haven't heard any news, have you?
Huck asks. No. She pauses. Huck, I have to say it. I'm haunted by all that money in Rosie's dresser.
That makes two of us.
Huck is uncomfortable talking about the Russ and Rosie mess at all, and he's glad they've avoided it all week. Cash said there were FBI agents watching the house when he got here, but I guess they've decided we're harmless because they haven't been back.
I told you, AC, nothing to worry about, Huck says. Hey, listen, Maya is with Ayers tonight. Do you want to go to dinner? Say, Morgan's Mango?
Irene sighs. I'm just not ready to go out, she says. It's too soon.
I get it, Huck says. I have some of that Wahoo from yesterday and I hid those cookies. Why don't you come to my place and I'll cook for you?
I should probably go on home, Irene says, but thank you. He nearly offers to grab some barbecue from Candy's, enough for everyone, but then he thinks,
she's telling you no, Sam Powers.
And can he blame her? She's just spent 5 days straight trapped with him out at sea on a 26-foot boat. Is it any wonder she wants to get away and have some time to herself? This is what Huck should want as well. After all, the last person he'd wanted to spend his free time with during the past 3 years was Adam. When he bumped into Adam at Joe's Rum Hut or the beach bar, which happened plenty of times, they would wave and not say a word to each other. But what Huck wants now is to see more of Irene. In fact, he feels bereft at the idea of an entire weekend without her. Maya is with Ayers tonight, which means Huck will be home alone. He can, in theory, crack open a cold beer and try to finish his damn book. Or he could wander over to the Rum Hut, then to the beach bar, then go up to the banana deck. He hasn't been up to the banana deck since the new year. Well, yeah, he thinks, because Rosie died. Maybe Irene is right. Maybe it is too soon to go out to dinner and have a nice time. Maybe they should just stay home and reflect, confer with their attorneys, and wonder what the hell happened. Then Huck remembers that Maya and her little friend who goes to Antilles, Shane, are planning to see the baobab tree with Cash.
I hear Maya is planning a hike with Cash, Huck says.
That's nice, Irene says. They're forging a relationship. It is nice, Huck agrees. He notices that Irene doesn't suggest they forge a relationship outside of work, off this boat. And what can Huck conclude but that Irene isn't interested in him? Somehow he never considered this. Somehow he'd let himself believe that her interest in him matched his interest in her. Was it strange as all get out that Irene's husband and Huck's stepdaughter had been in a secret relationship and had a love child? Hell yes. Too strange, maybe. Huck should just forget about it. He should be grateful that he and Irene are friends and now co-workers and that they don't hate each other and aren't in litigation over God knows what, money or the villa or Maya. Huck watches Irene as she strolls off the dock, carrying her reusable shopping bag filled with snacks. He scratches his face. Maybe he should shave his beard. Or read some Jane Austen. The next morning, the phone rings, and Huck assumes it'll be Maya asking to stay with Ayers a little longer. If that's the case, he might see if Irene wants to take a drive out to the East End. He'll offer to bring Flo.